11 a.m. on?
11 a.m. We're open at 11 the whole day. It will be the whole day. But tonight I'm delighted to have Rob Schmidt and Stuart Goodnick return to Many Rivers as speakers. They return to Many Rivers frequently, like as founders, workers, repairmen.
Yeah. I was wondering where you were going to go.
Accountants, salespeople, tea masters. Yeah, like the list is long. You know, like Rob and Stuart have been teachers in the Thai meditation tradition for many years, and they are two of the founders of Many Rivers Books and Tea. And tonight they'll be speaking about conscious suffering and spontaneous ignition. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So I'm told that I have to start this evening. Although I think I usually start.
I get that. I don't think so.
So contrary to what you may have read in the description of this talk, this is not a talk about Chinese Qigong, spontaneous ignition, which is, there's a little bit of a typo in one of our advertorials, although it almost reads properly that I think Chinese Qigong, spontaneous ignition makes a certain kind of sense, because we often think of this explosive energy in the Qigong tradition. But we're here to talk about a different kind of ignition, and the sorts of words that are often associated with spontaneous ignition and combustion is the word initiation. And initiation really begins to describe a starting point on real spiritual work. And so part of what we want to talk about tonight is what might be considered the initiation into genuine self-inquiry. And initiation is usually accompanied by some sort of energetic event or energetic shift. And what we describe by conscious suffering is, in fact, just such a initiatory act, because until one actually engages in what we will describe as conscious suffering, one tends to have something of a passive relationship to one's work. And conscious suffering and the engagement in conscious suffering actually represents a shift in the phase of one's practice, in that one begins to engage actively in the process of transformation. And this is somewhat paradoxical, because so much of spiritual literature describes the need to stop doing, stop trying to do things, to stop trying to achieve. And yet, in our tradition, which is very much aligned with the Fourth Way tradition, there's also an inherent notion of effort. And often it's a paradoxical to try to reconcile these things, because on the one hand, there's great truth in the fact that you can't do anything, and it's the stopping of doing that, in fact, represents the beginning of work on self. And yet, at the same time, there's a very real requirement to make a certain kind of effort. And conscious suffering, it describes in part what that effort might be. An example that came up recently in one of our study groups that characterizes this somewhat for me is that we were describing some of our students, or we're engaging with our students and talking about some of the work that they were dealing with, some issues, some personal issues that they were engaged in. And it was interesting that there was a tendency for a number of people, actually, to engage with their efforts through a filter of great self-criticism. Now, there is a great sense of, oh, I can't do this, or this is very difficult for me to engage in. This is too hard for me. There's this typically this flood, almost like a cloud, that would surround a couple of students in particular when they would engage in some fairly difficult boundaries within themselves that had to do with pushing themselves in terms of openness or honesty beyond what they had conventionally been involved in. And the interesting thing was that if you look at that kind of self-criticism, there's this holding on to a particular persona or a holding on to oneself in a way that's self-fulfilling. You know, if I can't do this, I can't do it, and that I pretty much will create that reality. But in the description and in the discussion that we had following this situation, we were describing the analogy of when one plays a musical instrument, often, you know, one has the idea that you can engage with a teacher and the teacher will show you a pattern or show you a riff and then you'll try to engage with that. And although sometimes it's frustrating and we struggle with that, we have a notion that it's okay to work with a teacher and it's okay to have someone tell us that, oh, we could play that better. The thing that's strange about spiritual work is that you know, we tend to either put it into the categories of vast, transformational, powerful enlightenment, where we're all, you know, it's such a big thing that you know, it's a very remote reality. But when we actually deal with the real possibility of changing ourselves, changing emotional habit patterns that we've had all our lives, all of a sudden we get back to this place of, oh, I can't do this, or this is too hard, or this is an impossible thing for me. And so in the discussion that we had, we were trying to, you know, kind of work around this thing is, why is it the case that the relationship to our emotional habit patterns, the relationship we have to what in the fourth way is we simply consider another instrument, that is our emotional center. Why is our relationship to that so different than, say, our relationship to a guitar or a piano? Now, why is it that I can think about playing the piano and take instructions and be willing to be told that that's not right, or reflect on the fact that I need to practice to make this better? But if I am confronted with needing to practice or needing to make myself better in terms of my ability to be more open emotionally or to put attention on other people rather than always on myself, that all of a sudden we look at that as some sort of personal indictment, or like that's some sort of failure on our parts. And either we get angry and, you know, storm off, or we get depressed and, you know, sulky because we'll never be able to make any progress here. So it's an interesting distinction. And the distinction is about this notion that we have in this practice called identification, where when we are identified, we hold on to a particular picture of ourselves or feeling of ourselves or energetic sensation of ourselves. And in that process, we get frozen, because when we're identified, we can't see anything other than that. So the practice of conscious suffering, to get back to my original notion of it being sort of the first initiation, or at least one of several initiations in this kind of practice, what conscious suffering is about is going towards this notion of identification and actually experientially giving us the ability to practice stepping outside of identified states of mind. There's energy there, because the identification is sort of like a stiction or sort of like a glue. And for any of you who have a background in chemistry, when you break a bond between two atoms that are held together, there's usually a release of energy. And in that sense, the breaking of the bond of identification, such that we can look at ourselves and act against what we habitually have done, gives rise to a release of energy. So that's the beginning. Now it's your turn.
let's open it up to questions first and see if there's any questions, comments.
That's cheating.
Damn right.
Stalling for time.
Yes, what will I say?
You're referring to this type of practice.
Mm-hmm.
I believe you use those words. I'm sorry, but I'm completely new here. I was intrigued by the topic, and I don't know what this type of practice
okay.
is.
Well, I'll give you just a very brief outline. The tradition in which we work, a Tayu Meditation Center, draws some of its functional or practical ideas from what's called the Fourth Way tradition, which is a tradition that was originally brought to the West by a mystic named George Gurdjieff. There's a primary practice in that tradition that's called self-observation. And self-observation is likened to practices like mindfulness in that one engages in the ability, or one cultivates the ability, to look at the functioning of one's organism, that is, the thoughts that arise, the feelings that arise, and the sensations that resonate throughout the body from a perspective of a witness that does not speak or analyze or conceptualize those phenomena. So we're trying to have a direct energetic relationship to a thought that arises, a feeling that arises, or a sensation in the body. So that's part of the practice. But then, in that, with that foundation, then there are practices known as intentional efforts, and conscious suffering is one of them, in which one begins to act against the grain of the habit patterns that we might find ingrained in our organisms, in our minds, in our hearts, and in our bodies. And it's that conscious suffering, or that acting against the habit patterns, that is the subject of the talk. Often, though, when we talk about this tradition, you know, we'll talk a lot about self-observation, because that's a foundational practice, and it creates the space within which we can do these other more sophisticated practices. Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I found myself, you triggered a memory of me taking typing class in high school and being told...
A happy memory.
and being introduced to the notion of lightened period, and learning that when you're first starting to learn, you get up to maybe 25, 30 words a minute, and no matter how hard you try, you can't get past there. And then you just put it aside for a month or 2 months or 3 months, and suddenly you come back and you're doing 40, 50, 60 words a minute. So there is that active investment in the moment and in the learning and in the craft, and then there is the period of letting go and acknowledging it, and then suddenly you come back and you're... So I was wondering about latent period, and I mean, would you call it active period of learning? And then there's a period where this learning is going on that you're not in touch with at all, but it's just happening. It's just there. It's just going on.
It's complicated, because there are, you in the fourth way view. The composition of the human organism, there are a couple of different parts of the organism, and one part is sometimes called the ego, the part that has all the rules and regulations, that has imbibed habits that have been more or less successful at helping one negotiate the human social universe in all its intricacies, because it has lots of intricacies. And those are, however, held in this portion of the mind, the ego, in such a way that one never actually incorporates those into the essence, if you wish to use that word, the essence of one's being. So it's like kind of like an overlay, a membrane which has all this information, but that information doesn't penetrate in ordinary circumstances into the beingness. So conscious suffering from another perspective, I mean, there's lots of ways to describe this topic of conscious suffering and learning through conscious suffering. So one of the ways to look at it is that the knowing, the cloud of knowing that Stuart was described, sort of a fog that we carry around, which is all these ideas about what we're supposed to do, who we're supposed to be, how we can act with this person but not with that person, and vice versa, etc. All that stuff, which is not part of the central, our hearts, the central essence of who we understand and feel ourselves to be and experience ourselves to be, we need to find some way to deal with this cloud of knowing. All these things that know we're not supposed to say such and such to so and so. We should never do X, Y, and Z in place A, B, and C. You know, it's very complicated. It's very complicated. And we imbibe many of these rules not by someone laying out the law, but because we observe as children how people actually act. And those unexamined rules are even more a pervasive form of this cloud of what I'm calling this cloud of knowing, which surrounds that mysterious unknowing that we rarely get a chance to open ourselves to, or open such that it can be touched by the universe. So conscious suffering is a way to create an opening in this cloud of knowing, so that there can be a learning that happens at a profound level where no thought is necessary. That's the other thing that comes out of our particular tradition, Taiyu, is the understanding of thought. And thought, as we would describe it, is the action of the ego. It is the repetition in the mind of the voices that we've heard, the voice of our mommy telling us to look both ways before we cross the street, the voices of our friends, of our teachers, colleagues, lovers, siblings, everyone. These voices that contain information that are absorbed not into the heart, but into the cloud of knowing that surrounds it all, that we carry around and maintain with the energy of our being. This cloud of knowing would collapse. When we die, it will collapse. And sometimes before we die, to a greater or lesser extent, the cloud of knowing will cease to be. So we have to maintain it with the injection of energy on a regular, consistent basis. And we can inscribe some things into the body, like you learn how to drive a car, and you don't think about it after you learn how to do it. You go through that tremendously terrifying period, at least for some of us, do I put my foot here? What do I do with this foot? All these things. But once you get the hang of it, then you don't have to think about it. Well, what we're suggesting is that through conscious suffering, spontaneous ignition can be achieved, in which there is no thought necessary to direct our actions moment by moment. Instead, a spontaneous arising of more or less perfect action arises, or perfect in the sense that sometimes our beingness needs to learn something. and needs to be able to get feedback. With the cloud of knowing around us, it's all shielded. Being, the essence is shielded. Nothing gets through. So it's complicated. And your analogy is well taken, but it needs to be expanded and complicated to help to fit it into this other model. But Betty had the first question.
Well, I take it what I'm hearing is that there is a period of latency where there's no conscious thought going on, but something is germinating in one of your centers that will lead to a knowing.
Well, yes and no. There's probably all kinds of conscious thought going on, but what we want
not
to do
concerned with what you're
right. What we want to be able to do is create the conditions such that this essence or heart is actually touched and actually has direct contact with the universe, unmediated by the cloud of knowing. And that might be that might arise in conditions where some aspect of the cloud of knowing is triggered, which has nothing whatsoever to do with what the being is learning. Unbeknownst to it, the ego or the egos of anybody else around.
I'd like to give a concrete example. We're talking about conscious suffering and using that terminology. So let's give an example of sort of a traditional example. Gurdjieff, in one of his masterworks, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, An Impartial View of the Life of Man, describes conscious suffering, also known as intentional suffering, as the willingness to put yourself into contact with someone that you don't particularly like. So think about that for a moment. Our ordinary cloud of knowing, as Rob described it, functions in the following way. You're walking down the street, you see someone you really, really don't like, or someone who annoys the heck out of you. This person's walking your way. What do you do? Do you just tighten up? Do you look the other way? Pretend you don't see this person? Do you cross the street? There's all sorts of things that we do to avoid that contact because, you know, this person really annoys us. You know, they for whatever reason, maybe they make us feel uncomfortable, maybe they're, always in a bad mood, whatever. But we try to avoid that person. So conscious suffering as a practice means we recognize that momentum of habit pattern that is generated by this cloud of knowing that Rob described, that is a habit pattern that probably has roots in our emotional center, our mental center, and probably our body as well, because sometimes when we're around people who annoy us, we actually shiver and shake and, you know, are sort of like an animal trapped in a trap trying to escape. But in this practice, conscious suffering is the willing recognition of that and the intentional act to actually not only not avoid this person, but to move towards this person and to put full attention on this person. That's an example of conscious suffering. That's an example of a particular manifestation of the practice as it is reflected in something outside of ourselves that we want to avoid. However, there are other aspects of conscious suffering that might arise in connection with a thought or a perception or a complex of feelings that arises in ourselves that we might want to avoid. If you ever deal with a memory of being embarrassed about something, you'll notice that there's this inherent tendency for that to want to slip away from our attention when we linger towards it. So that's an example of conscious suffering. And I want to tie together some of the points we were making earlier. The reason that I call conscious suffering an initiatory kind of practice is that it requires a certain kind of something, a certain kind of presence, or a certain kind of self-awareness to even be in a position to engage with one's internal life in such a way that one would recognize that this is something to do that might have some merit. That the actual going against these very real habit patterns that tend to define the passive flow of our day-to-day experience might be something that's a worthwhile thing to do. That might change something for us. That might actually create for us possibilities that didn't exist there before. So that's a concrete example.
So just to tie that to the question that we had to start with, the way that you can, or the way that we that practitioners can recognize what something real to do might be along the lines of conscious suffering, is through having first begun this practice of self-observation or something equivalent thereto, such that one can begin to recognize with some impartiality what's actually going on as opposed to one's illusion, self-generated illusions, the stories we tell ourselves about what's actually going on. So conscious suffering, as Stuart said, is predicated on something, and that predicate is self-observation practice or some other equivalent practice. Michelle?
So you're talking about breaking through the myth in our head about that person or that thing.
The many myths, yeah.
And going and experiencing it with maybe beginner's mind, the concept of innocence, allowing what comes to come without putting all of those prejudices and beliefs upon
us. Right. So that's where Stuart mentioned earlier this issue of people being told that it's important to be able to let go and not do. Mm-hmm. And
so that's where the not knowing comes in.
Yes, but it's actually not very easy to not do at the beginning when one's attention is pulled hither, thither, and yon by every little scintilla of this cloud of knowing, each of which claims to know the truth. The cloud of knowing, I call it that because it's a cacophony of voices insisting, each one, I have the truest truth. Listen to me, and I will set you straight. So we engage in self-observation so that we can actually step back from that cacophony and have some silence. From that silence, then, that you're just describing, from that beginner's mind, then one can actually begin to actually do something like conscious suffering, as Stuart was saying. So,
question.
I think Betty actually had the next one.
About meeting someone you don't like or you react badly to. To me, that's just a big warning signal, and I don't make any judgments. I step back and say, what is there in me that this is triggering? And try to be an impartial judge of that. And I don't avoid those people. I do try to interact with them. And often something is released. I don't feel that way about them after I know them a little better, make an effort to know them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Paul.
What I was guessing is, given the walls I have, the protecting mechanisms that I have, what are the things in this cloud that I can use to challenge this from willing? Is a willingness to fall to pieces? Is that willingness to just sort of fall apart? Mm-hmm. Which means emotionally, the emotions come up, and the emotions of emotions that I've been holding down, I've been holding under control for long periods of time. So it's a willingness to be incredibly threatened, consciously threatened, especially by somebody who I'm experiencing as threatening, which seems triply threatening, rather than using my usual defensive mechanisms to try to control the situation and myself. It seems like that's one way to challenge consciously, rather easily. the cloud. It doesn't mean it's going to dissipate, but it challenges the cloud. It shifts the cloud.
Right. I think what they... And the challenge and the interesting thing about that question is that the willingness to do that is means that we truly have to be prepared for anything. So it's not just sufficient to, you know, let emotions out that we've been repressing necessarily. That might be useful, but at the same time, it may be appropriate that those two are reactive impulses that we need to hold. I think the key in this that it's important is that we're trying in this process to become bigger from all of those little pieces, and that means that we have to be able to contain them or allow them to be present simultaneously with contradictory thoughts and urges. And for us in our presence to actually literally be outside of the bounds of all of those little voices and all the little components of that cloud. And in that place, then, as Rob was describing, when we have that kind of ability to hold all of these contradictory things simultaneously and to be aware of them in ourselves simultaneously, then a knowing can arise from a different place as to what is the appropriate thing to do in this moment. And that's then it's not being driven by any of these pieces, but it's being it's arising out of a totality of who we are.
It seems to me, if I may continue this a little more, that to allow this explosion to occur, or this opening to occur, and my attempts, like it's sort of slow witness of witnessing myself, doesn't really get it. There has to be a certain danger that I have to be willing to go through. I've got a certain risk I've got to take. And in this, it's just the risk taking that allows something to unfold that I have no anticipation of, and that I'm willing to let happen without trying to manipulate it. And the results will just shift the system around. But I'm not trying to manage it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's well put. The catchphrase that I've often used in talks like this to describe that process, or to give a succinct sort of magic formula as a reminding factor for this process, is to follow your dread. Mm-hmm. Because it's the arising of dread in ourselves, particularly the emotional manifestation of dread, which represents, it's the habitual organism's defense mechanism against going towards something that is perceived as dangerous. And dread can be arising as something as mundane as if you're into telesales, picking up a call and making a cold call to someone where you're very likely to be rejected. Or dread may arise in having to describe a difficult truth about yourself to someone else that you're in relationship with. There's lots of ways in which dread can arise, but it has this unifying element, and it actually does. The nice thing about dread is that it functions precisely as in the way that you were describing, which is we're so conditioned to avoid that which we dread that if we move towards dread, the conventional mind, the cloud of knowing, as Rob described it, begins to shut down. Because it's sort of like short-circuiting a robot. It can't function in that place because it's all about avoiding that place. Mm-hmm. And so when you move towards the fire of dread, all of a sudden there is the possibility of transformation. And that's the notion of ignition that we're capturing in the title for this talk, because when that fire burns, there can be change. We don't know what it is. The mind cannot manage it. All we can really know is that we trust that moving in that direction will enable a process which is natural for ourselves.
But there's a complication here, and that's that Stuart describes the situation where stress short circuits temporarily the operation, and to a certain extent, varying with circumstances, the operation of this cloud of knowing, the constituent elements thereof, and sort of as if they're charged particles, and suddenly they're neutralized, if briefly, however briefly or however long, through the creation of stress through either the most specific example of following your dread or another example of conscious suffering, of this deliberate movement. But people have the experience of shutting down the cloud of knowing to a greater or lesser extent in lots of arenas of life. You know, you might learn how to do it by playing basketball, where it's simply your body has to go too fast to keep up with the sport, to allow yourself to dwell your energy. You stop giving so much energy, in other words, to the cloud of knowing in that sort of circumstance. Other people, it might be getting on a stage, whether it's to do public speaking, to as an actor or actress, singer, whatever it happens to be, performer. There's lots of ways. It might be jumping out of an airplane, or rappelling down the side of a hill. You know, physical danger can help create the kind of stress that will, to a greater or lesser extent, have this effect temporarily. Once the elements of the cloud of knowing become familiar with the new behavior, then it's as if the effect is anesthetized or ameliorated, such that eventually the thing that once was so productive of this useful stress no longer has the same effect. So we're looking for something here. We're looking for a spontaneous ignition that uses either a different fuel or a different order of magnitude of fuel than these other processes are used to do. Michelle?
I guess I just had this image. You're going through following all of your dreads, and suddenly you run out of dreads. There's a repetitive factor, I know, but...
Well, I think that
I guess, would that eventually be the spontaneous ignition as you finally rise above all your dreads?
Well, it would be nice if it were additive in that way. And what I'm suggesting, though, is that it is not additive, because when, let's say, you ran out of the easily accessed forms of stress that I've given some examples thereof, you run out of those and you haven't maintained a practice of self-observation. You haven't started the doing of conscious suffering at a more profound level. Those surface points of access are limited in number, and they exhaust a certain kind of energy. I know a number of people who've, you know, over decades have challenged themselves in a variety of ways to keep producing this kind of stress. Do they achieve spontaneous ignition in or of the magnitude that we're talking about here? No, not necessarily. In fact, probably extraordinarily rarely. So there's another trick going on here. Yeah.
You're talking about basketball as an example. Sometimes in tennis, there's something called the inner game of tennis, mm-hmm. where your conscious mind isn't engaging particularly. Everything goes, it's flowing. You just are instinctively hitting the ball where mm-hmm. you want it. And what is that? Is that another temporary shutdown of the cloud of knowing? Or is that some kind of harnessing of all of your centers where you're achieving that inner-directedness?
It's a good question, and it depends on the person and the particulars. I was just listening last night to this interview with Andre Agassi, famous tennis player, one of the great tennis players And he was saying how he never wanted to play tennis. His father drove him to it, essentially. His father loved tennis and was and pushed the son. Now the son imbibed this form of stress and learned to push it as far as it can, that can be pushed, and described some moments where he was in such extraordinary pain at the conclusion. Actually, he was describing this one moment at the conclusion of his last U.S. Open, which he won barely, where he's lying with the guy he beat on these two tables. They're both in such extraordinary physical pain. Their muscles are all seized up. They're waiting for the doctors to come. He told everyone to get out of the room, and the two of them just sat. And actually, the one guy reached out his hand and held Agassi's hand, and they sort of watched the video monitor that was replaying the match, and sort of remembering just this extraordinary link that they'd had. Now that's a wonderful thing. That's an extraordinary moment, and something I'm sure he'll treasure always. I even treasure having heard about it. But is it the spontaneous ignition that ignites more than just the area, the specific arena? Spontaneous ignition, as I'm talking about it, is something that engulfs the entirety of the ego, in the same way that it encompasses the ego in the or the cloud knowing, as Stuart was describing it earlier.
Yeah. I'm struggling a little bit with this idea of spontaneous ignition and wondering if you can give a concrete example of that.
Would that I could.
Does anyone have a match?
I'm not clear on how it relates to the conscious, how you get to the spontaneous ignition and what it is exactly from the conscious, the choice of the conscious.
Well, let me just do one thing, and then I think Stuart can talk about the conscious suffering part. But I just want to address the question of what the spontaneous ignition might be, just a little bit, the taste of it. And that taste would be the sensation that you are not paying any attention to what the voices in your head might be telling you to say or do or feel. Instead, one speaks entirely without the scripting or the the arbiter who decides, yes, you can say this, no, you can't say that. Almost everything that most people say, most of the time, goes through a sensor. That's the word I was looking for. Some kind of internal censoring mechanism. And the sort of spontaneous ignition that I'm talking about has no such mechanism. Or that mechanism is observed neutrally and simply not utilized in any way, shape, or form. It is sort of like a vestigial tail.
That was fun, didn't it?
So enough conscious suffering, if you make enough choices for conscious suffering and dedicate a real practice to that, do you end up in a place where you're in spontaneous ignition all the time? Is that the goal, or...?
That is certainly one way to put it. Although usually, and certainly in my own view, there's the opening to something bigger than oneself, sometimes described as grace, which makes the shift or lights the match. But you have to create. You have to build the match. You have to put it in the right place, and then you have to hope for the grace of lightning to ignite the match, might be another way to put it. So the conscious suffering is the is the creation of conditions such that that match will in fact ignite, and that it is placed correctly or is big enough or whatever metaphor you want to use, that it will in fact not just ignite some small part of the cloud of knowing and burn it off, but will in fact do something much more profound.
I'll add to that that the first the spontaneous ignition is hard to describe precisely because it's an experiential thing. So that we already we're kind of at the bounds of what language is going to do for us. But one way to look at it that sort of is reflected in many spiritual traditions is if it is possible for you to have so profound an encounter of the true nature of oneself such that thereafter you know evermore that the contents of consciousness are not what you are, that would represent something that we could call a spontaneous transformation, call it a phase change or a state change. But when you have that experience in an unmistakable way, such that every corner of your being resonates with the knowing of that experience, it's hard to go back to the kind of identified consciousness that typifies the ordinary experience. Now, what Rob was describing earlier in terms of exceptional experiences that people have, some people getting up on stage create stressful conditions where the mind shuts down temporarily, but when they get off stage, they're reading the reviews. How'd I do? it's so there are moments for all of us where we have some notion of what the taste of this kind of experience is like. But the spontaneous ignition that we're talking about represents a fundamental shift in the way in which the organism operates. And that shift is not something that you can do in a kind of mechanical sense. We can't guarantee that if you do this, this, and this, and this, that all of this stuff will happen. What we can say is that the nature of our organisms and the nature of our beings are very much like the nature of a seed, which the seed contains within it the DNA to allow a plant to emerge. But in order for the seed to germinate and to mature into a plant, there needs to be cultivation of conditions. It has to be planted into the appropriate soil with the right nutrients. There needs to be a regulation of temperature. There needs to be sunlight, water. And then there needs to be favorable conditions and care and nurturing as the plant germinates and grows. And eventually, this little seed may turn into something as majestic as an oak tree. Who would have known? The other thing that's, and this is a kind of a very fourth way concept, is lots of seeds are thrown out there and not as many trees grow. So it's not a necessary function for us as biological organisms to spontaneously ignite in the way that we're describing. And so it's not a given that it happens in this body in this lifetime. I won't speak about the energetic patterns inhabiting the body and what the ultimate destiny for all of us are as spirits, but I will say that it is not a given that this happens for these biological organisms in this particular lifetime. So there has to be some sort of active element. There has to be a need inherent in the organism that is strong enough to give oneself the inspiration to engage in the kind of work that we're describing to actually create the conditions necessary for this kind of ignition to take place. So, and that's actually kind of a strong claim. A question over here.
You haven't used words like awakening or enlightenment. Some traditions. I'm wondering if that would be the way that this was described, and I'm wondering if this is something that, if you're lucky, happens once in your life, or can this happen several times? I'm trying to get more of a sense.
Okay. Well, we just to clarify, you know, we've certainly said earlier that it's possible to have moments of clarity mm-hmm. where the normal kind of identified functioning of the organism subsides, and there's a moment of lucidity where we touch upon and have a direct experience of our true nature.
Maybe some psychic breeze blows the cloud of knowing mm-hmm. away for a moment or two.
Or you might, sit darshan with a very powerful teacher who's emanating a quality of energy that creates that kind of condition.
A transmission.
Yeah.
It's more like solar wind, I think, is what he's describing.
I would reserve transmission for a more permanent process.
Okay.
But certainly, sitting darshan can give people a taste of. Mm-hmm. A certain something. But so we have these experiences. The question is, do those experiences become the norm? Is there an ongoing functioning in which our relationship to ourselves and our lives is different than the starting place, which is mm-hmm. a more identification with a psychological functioning
mm-hmm.
Or a functioning as a, you know, as a body of sensations. You know, it's not just the stories in our heads, it's also the emotional habits and the physical habits in our bodies that are at stake here.
So they can create shifts.
And spiritual traditions have a vocabulary for these kinds of awakening moments, and certainly the term awakening is a term that we will often use. Enlightenment's kind of overloaded these days, and so it suffers from, you know, too many attempts to, you know.
It's like the word love.
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Right, which is one of the reasons that we're actually trying to stay away from jargon,
mm-hmm.
or if we use jargon, it's jargon that is peculiar to our tradition, so that. Right. Yeah.
My understanding is that we have an impartial observer in our makeup, and that what you're trying to do here is free the impartial observer from this overlay of societal responses. And when you're operating from the impartial observer, then you can speak clearly and freely and without all of the censoring going on or the shaping of your words. Is that a state of spontaneous ignition?
Well, I would say, in terms of our way of expressing this, I would say that most of us start out with the capacity to activate
the
impartial witness.
This is the seed that
right.
you're cultivating then.
And that in our, the starting point and the way that our consciousness gets constructed in ourselves during our developmental period is that initial sort of open, objective mm. consciousness and receptive consciousness gets overlaid, as you said, with a different kind of consciousness, which is one in which our identity is completely locked to structures, you know, psychological, you know, mental structures, emotional structures, and physical sensation structures, and that yes, so that capacity is in there. What we do in practice is to activate that. Our efforts are to begin to practice actions of self-observation, and generally. People find that that's a difficult thing to do, because it's like, you know, balancing on top of a beach ball. Everything in your life is pushing you off and wanting you to go back to the normal habit patterns of having a thought, being in the thought, being in the feeling, and then associating from there to the next thought and feeling.
Instead of observing it.
Right. So the observing. Yeah. So the observing is. A component of what we're talking about, but it is not it's not just the impartial witness that is the process we're talking about.
But it is important to stress that creating an impartial witnessing function in one's consciousness is not a trivial matter. In fact, it is extraordinarily difficult because the habits of identification are very deceptive. Attention is very slippery and gets pulled into identification without our even knowing it. We don't even see it happening. Unless we've done all these efforts over a considerable amount of time for most of us, with the help of people, spiritual friends who have gone before, who can offer advice from time to time about this sort of thing, in order to get some useful feedback that will let us know when we've just gone off the rail and don't even know it, which happens all too easily with the extraordinary propensity that we have to identify with these elements in the cloud, these little voices in the cloud of knowing, each of which, you'll recall I said, insists that it has the truth. The truth is in this one. No, 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 it's in this one. No, 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 it's in this one. They're all ready to tell you that if you just identify with me, all will be well. And derailing that meta habit is a non-trivial achievement, to costing, say the least.
Costing not less than everything.
Right. Then identification with everything, which is that is everything to most of us.
Isn't there a traditional Buddhist practice that offers you insight into meditating, watching yourself meditate, so that it begins to set you up with the concept of the observer in your internal world?
There's lots of practices, any genuine tradition has something, has some, in my view at least, has some relatively equivalent practice of creating some distance between the habit of identification and this other functioning.
But I want to be careful, and this is where we start getting into the subtlety of this whole arena, because even the words you used, setting up the concept of the observer, is layering the conceptual apparatus over what we're talking about. And the key, if probably the most profound, if I were to take the most profound thing the founder of our tradition, Robert Innes, said repeatedly, was that the observer that we're talking about is silent. And that's probably the most useful thing you can take from this talk, is that if the observer is functioning, it's silent. If there's a voice, if there's a thought, if there is a narrative about what you're thinking, that's not the observer. And to get to a place of functioning of the observer that's silent is actually a very, very difficult thing, because we have a tendency to rush in with our minds when we engage in this kind of practice to figure out what's going on. But self-observation isn't a figuring out what's going on. We don't care about the content. We don't care about the story in one sense. One story is not really distinguished from another story. What we care about is the presence, the energetic presence of attention that can behold the functioning of our organism in a given moment and hold in awareness the actual state of functioning that we find ourselves in without reacting to it, without immediately moving to the mechanically next associative thought or the reactive emotion or the twitch of the body that comes in response to that which we're observing. And the ability to hold that space is the observer functioning. The observation, self-observation, isn't about content. It isn't about figuring out who we are. It's about establishing energetic presence. And when we establish that energetic presence, we are establishing space. And in that space comes a kind of a ability to grow beyond the contents that we are beholding in the act of observation. And when we grow beyond that content, suddenly there's space for a different kind of functioning. We don't have to talk about doing anything. All we have to do is talk about what we do to create the conditions necessary to allow a greater process and a greater phase of being to take place.
Yeah.
So if I'm hearing you right, because this is the kind of a question that's been going through me around, the cloud of knowing. It's like one arena where we identify that which we have aversion to, habitually move away. Instead, we move towards, which brings a certain amount of energy forth.
Mm-hmm.
And now what you're talking about, this observer that has capacity to hold this and not know and not get into the, material of it, so to speak, the conceptual, the what's going on, the ego. And, one's very powerful on one side, the cloud of knowing and the contents and what's being generated. And then there's this observer that's just holding it all and making lots of allowance and capacity to hold it. So in my more egoic, I guess, framework of trying to understand this, how do those two integrate? How do they, where there's such a great space that this ignition or what you're speaking about can happen without, engaging it?
Well, one way to think about ignition is that it's caused by friction. Friction happens automatically in this cloud of knowing, but it is not held in a space within which enough, the heat and gas, whatever would create the conditions. In the write-up for this, I used the analogy of the oily cloths in the garage, which if there's an enclosed space with enough oxygen coming in and there are other proper conditions, then those can suddenly ignite. Okay, so conscious suffering is the creation of a chamber within which this friction can actually cause ignition. But we've talked about the different scales that this can occur at. If we're going to have the spontaneous ignition of the entirety of the ego, then we need a pretty big chamber. And that is not the product of short-lived or trivial, no matter how intense, short-lived or trivial effort. It means that we need to expand consciousness, our attention, ability to hold things within consciousness, to a great degree, such that we can hold within this chamber the elements that cause that when they are present together, cause friction to arise. And if you get enough of them in a big enough space, this is all metaphorical, of course, then that conscious suffering can create the condition of friction such that the spontaneous ignition can occur. Now, the problem, of course, is that friction doesn't necessarily feel very good. Darn! What a bummer. We've got to be able to learn to hold these disparate, competing, antagonistic, opposite elements together lovingly, not changing their nature, so that the friction will actually have an effect. That's why the self-observation has to be entirely neutral and partake not of judgment.
Would the development of both mindfulness and concentration, mm-hmm. and I'm again kind of coming back to this capacity, you know, which you sort of, I hear you pointing towards, you would be able to do it. I mean, at a certain
yeah.
It's
not impossible, otherwise we wouldn't be here.
A more precise way to say it is that you are able to create the conditions by which this process can take place. I want to be careful of the language of you would be able to do it, because what that means in this context is not a given as to what is you at this point. So, but I wanted another way, another metaphor for describing, you know, the kind of contrast you were describing of here is this sort of spacious observer function, and here is this sort of identified functioning of mind. The thing, when we observe ourselves and we're able to maintain that neutrality, there's a quality that the best word we have for it is presence. That is what we cultivate. We cultivate greater presence. So if I can stand neutrally, non-reactively in the face of the functioning of my intellectual, emotional, and physical center, there's a kind of a presence. There's a kind of a stability. But the energy that is contained in identified mind is actually a fairly high energy. Because you know that if you concentrate on something, just like if you take your mind and you concentrate on something and focus it down, it takes a lot of energy. That's high energy. Well, our identifications are is sort of a repository of energy. And so the act of self, or the act of conscious suffering, is a way in which we start to liberate that energy. And when we're able to follow our dread, to step against the reactive force that would have us retract from a certain something, whether it's like an honest moment, for instance, with a romantic partner. As soon as we pass through that, and everyone has had the experience of this, there's kind of a sense of release. Like, what was that all about? You know, there's an opening. That opening, that happening, is because that intense focused energy that was bound up in that identification has suddenly been redirected. And when it's redirected, and it's redirected without going to yet another identification, it becomes available for the deepening of this presence. And so the two actually work together. The acts of conscious suffering release the energy that's bound up in identified aspects of consciousness. And so the art of this practice is to go on and on and on releasing that kind of energy and
creating the chamber within which further work can occur.
Releasing or dissipating?
Releasing. Dissipating assumes that energy is bad, and my point is that the energy is simply the same quality of energy. If I sit here and stare at the letter G on this page at the exclusion of everything else, it bears in the same relationship to the fixation on a particular emotional or mental state or idea that we have. And, you know, and we have these things, we all know these things, you know, I've got some problem, and I'm gnawing on this problem, and all I can think about is this problem, and, you know, it could be a beautiful sunny day out, and the birds chirping in the sky, and I'm sitting here thinking about this this big problem. That's concentration of energy. And when we are able to release that energy, and this isn't something we do psychologically, because it's not a psychological, we can't just magically wave a psychological wand and say, oh, I don't feel this anymore. This is like these kinds of habits are in our skin. They're in our hearts, you know, they're in our nerve tissue. So we have to do something methodical to, you know, exercise ourselves against that until such time as that energy actually just gets redistributed into presence. And that's that creates more space.
So it's both consistency and spontaneity that we're attempting to create. But to create the space for spontaneity to arise, we have to be persistent and consistent in these efforts to establish a neutral witnessing function. Some ways it's better to think of it as a function, a process, not a thing, like I don't know, the most essential part of me or something like that. This little mini me inside my head or heart or something like that. This little imp in there. Because that personalizes it in a way that can distract from the fact that this impartial functioning is not just another little bit of the cloud of knowing, not just another little shard of the entirety of this organism, of this mind, of these emotions. It is of another nature. It's not, it doesn't feel like that other thing. Those other things feel. The other parts of consciousness feel. So it's a functioning. It's not just some yet another part of the cloud of knowing. And that's the trickiest part for the longest period of time. The trickiest part to achieve clarity about. It's not, and that's because of the nature of identification. Identification is so, our minds are so slippery, our emotions are so slippery. And, you know, before you know it, you feel like crap. Without even realizing how it happened. So we need to create something that does not partake of that ordinary up and down, yes and no functioning. And that's what this self-observation, impartial witnessing functioning does, which is itself part of an even greater process, which most of us need help to do. I mean, I can say pretty unequivocally that everyone I've ever met needed some help. Even, you know, the greatest spiritual teacher perhaps that I've ever met in person had a teacher. It's not something that most beings can do without assistance.
Which gets back to our original point about relating to this stuff like you'd relate to music lessons. You know, part of the challenge is recognizing that you need help.
Right.
It's just kind of a thought came in. I was wondering, did Christ have a teacher? And then did Buddha have a teacher?
It's a good question. Of course, with Jesus, who knows? There's insufficient information to know whether that's true. Buddha, we know, had a number of teachers, but we are told that none of them equaled or exceeded his achievement, and I think it's reasonable to credit that, at least as a hypothesis to work from. Although, of course, once again, how could we ever know that? And in fact, let's say you met the greatest teacher of this age, or somebody who people were claiming was the greatest teacher of this age. How would you know that, number one, that he or she had that capacity, and number two, that it was something that was the product of a spontaneous ignition.
Yeah, I was just thinking, kind of to answer that question, is like the way we go is how many books did they write?
Right.
How many, what's their education? What university did they graduate from? Who their teachers were? You know, their lineage.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and there's actually another point that I'll mention that doesn't get mentioned very often in this regard, which is that there are great spiritual beings whom you can sit darshan with and feel this kind of transporting, but that doesn't mean they're good teachers. You know, that's the best analogy I have of this is I study the Japanese flute, the shakuhachi, and I have someone I consider a profoundly great teacher in the sense that he's also a great player. But he's Japanese, but he came to the U.S. in the 70s because he felt the Japanese musical tradition was too confining for him. And he will often say that the traditional Japanese method of teaching is, you know, the teacher will play something and the student tries to imitate the teacher. And he says they do that because they don't know how to teach. And he's extremely precise in the sense that he can look at you and direct your attention in incredibly fine ways in terms of what you're doing with your attention and your body in order to create an objective change in the quality of the sound. So if you're interested in this kind of work, it's my recommendation is to find a good teacher, not necessarily, you know, the holiest person on the planet, because you can sit with a holy person and you may feel great, but when you're
back home,
when you're back home or you're out of their presence, then it's not so great anymore, or the same habit patterns may reemerge. And so in that sense, this is our prejudice as a school, I guess, but we don't have an ashram model because the idea of, you know, letting people sort of sit, you know, passively because there's an energy that's created in a space doesn't achieve this kind of permanent transformation that we're talking about. It requires a certain kind of effort. So we find it's useful to have a school context where there's intensity, but then people have to put that to work in their lives. They have to do this kind of practice on an ongoing basis and use the raw material of their own lives as the transformational raw material to provide the energy for this kind of transformation.
What's the difference between the great learner and the great teacher?
Well, a great teacher, in my view, has to have been a great learner. A great being does not have to be a great teacher. I think that's kind of what Stuart's saying.
Yeah, and that there's nothing wrong, you know, with, the hugging saint, Amon Damai, you know, a great, great, great being. Mm. And some would argue that the mere fact of their presence is a teaching in itself. And I'm not going to argue with that. I'm just simply saying that we're very pragmatic, and that's the part of the nature of the inspirations for our teaching. We're interested in the methodical creation of conditions such that this kind of spontaneous ignition is not only possible, but likely. Not guaranteed, but likely.
Isn't the teaching when the learning kind of like self ignites, I find something disturbing about making a distinction between the teacher and the learner, that there's just this point, this moment where the learning, where they're just not separate. are you saying there's a place where the teacher is no longer this student?
No, I wouldn't say that. But I wasn't saying that.
No, you weren't.
I wasn't saying that because to me the great to follow your lead, you know, if this will satisfy that, you know, that little itch there.
I'm not sure what I'm talking
about. Yeah, it's that a great teacher has to continually be a great student. I'll use my Shakuhachi teacher again. He says, "I'm a beginner. I'm just starting. I'm learning, and I have to teach you so that I have room to, you know, find out some new stuff." So, in some sense, the nature of the teaching function is a part of the process. You know, anything that we get in this kind of process, we have to be willing to give freely, not just because it's a nice thing to do out of a spirit of compassion and lawful and harmonious in the universe, but also because it helps to consolidate and to create more space in the way that we've been talking about.
In other words, it's a skillful creation of conditions to continually deepen one's own understanding. You have to keep giving things away. Betty?
Would either of you comment on the Zen saying, if you meet Buddha on the road, kill him?
Let's kill that saying.
Spoken like a teacher.
I'm tired of that one.
It's life-threatening.
What's that?
It's life-threatening. So follow your dread.
Where did it come from?
If a person says he's Buddha, he is a false Buddha. Kill him.
Oh. Right. Well, I mean, there's lots of ways in which false claims are made in one's inner life, as well as in one's exterior life, that is, in terms of people one meets. And in a way, making a distinction between the falseness in the inner life versus the outer life is itself a false distinction. So when we learn how to honor and be utterly, rabidly clear about one's own inner life, the truth and verity of every shred thereof, then one will have utter and absolute clarity about the people you meet. And then it doesn't matter these judgments. Are you a Buddha or are you not a Buddha? Who cares?
Well, this is very circular because to achieve this, say, you need a teacher.
Indeed! Darn, that's the way that's what we're saying is a matter of practicality, not a matter of theoretical necessity, because there have been a few instances in you know, the last century or two, and probably before, of that kind of achievement, but maybe that's just the product of lifetime after lifetime after lifetime after lifetime of encounters with teachers.
As far as Gurdjieff, he had teachers, or did he was he sort of full blown with this knowledge and his philosophy?
He was so crafty. We know he had teachers. Did he have a teacher in the formal sense? You know, he was so crafty. It's hard to know. But I don't honestly care, because what. You know, I don't look at that gift horse in the mouth. The horse itself is very beautiful and very efficient at taking me where I want to go. And that's the key thing. You know, the mind, mostly the mind and sometimes the emotion, want to say you're right and you're wrong to teachers, to whether it's a music teacher, a math teacher, as well as a teacher of life, which is a spiritual teacher. So the one thing, the basic thing that one can get from a spiritual teacher is to learn how to surrender having always to be right oneself, and to give that even once with the entirety of the organism, body, heart, and mind, with no reservation whatsoever. Then there is no distinction between teacher and student whatsoever. Indeed.
Well, Michael had a beautiful point in there about, doesn't the student draw from the teacher? Isn't there a requirement of some magical alchemy between the student and the teacher so that the teacher can transmit and sound like this wonderful instrument of knowing? Because, you know, the perfect student comes along and is just eager to draw that wisdom, that nectar, that knowing from them.
Indeed, and in a number of Buddhist and other traditions, the primacy of the teacher-student relationship is acknowledged in some ways above all other relationships, and is even asserted in some particular cases to transcend lifetime, one particular lifetime. So that doesn't. We're talking once again here, or I can bring in again the distinction I made earlier. It's not about the teacher in me or the student in me. It's about the teaching function in me, the learning function in me, and the identity of those two is something that, because we are embodied, we need to play out in these bodies, and not having that be wrong is tricky, and fraught with all kinds of opportunity for identification, because I always want to be right ultimately, and so surrendering. Being right, always, as I said earlier, with absolutely no reservations, is difficult, madam.
If you don't mind, I'd like to return for a moment to the trickiness or deceptiveness of the mind in doing this work.
Sure.
When you talked about conscious suffering throughout most of the evening, you talked about it as the effort to toward suffering, the effort to overcome this mass of energy that prevents you from approaching your suffering and taking the risk to approach it. And I guess my question is, how does your technology deal with the mind, or the phase of this practice where the mind wants to take refuge in suffering, or the habitual movement is to hide out in suffering, or
to wallow in suffering even. That's a really good question, and my first inclination is to make Stuart suffer by making him answer it, but I won't.
Rob, would you repeat the question? We couldn't quite hear it.
The question was about the tendency of. I think Madeline said the mind, but I would extend it to the emotions as well. In other words, the tendency to want to wallow in suffering, the tendency to want to go towards suffering compulsively, and that's kind of the distinction that we're talking about here. There is a very strong set of habits in ourselves that brings us, circles us back compulsively to recreate a certain set of sufferings again and again and again. And it's my contention that habit and tendency, that aspect of identification, is the manifestation of something different than it appears on the surface. We can say from the outside that, oh, that person is, you know, an alcoholic, say, is just recreating their suffering every night they go and, you know, imbibe a fifth or something like that, and is just compulsively recreating their suffering. But my contention is that people who are involved in that are not actually present to the suffering they are experiencing. In fact, they're doing everything they can. Well, they're doing everything they can not to look at the actual suffering involved. And so the cultivation of self-observation is thus an inescapable foundation to begin to have the capability to see the actual nature. But it takes more than... When you're talking about something as really profoundly well-established as that kind of suffering, then you need the foundation of self-observation, but then you need to be able eventually, when the self-observation habit, the habit of being conscious, at least in terms of neutral self-observation, is well enough established that you can actually start to play with the conditions within which that suffering is continually recreated. And that can involve, you know, I don't want to get into specifics of it, but there are ways in which we move towards things, move away from them sequentially, one after the other, in order to expand the range of experience while doing self-observation, and then eventually get to a place where moving towards and away happens within the chamber that I was talking about earlier, within this chamber of conscious attention, such that the whole range of possible movement is a part of this creation of friction, which can, in fact, ignite something interesting. Does that make any sense? It's a little hard to talk about when you get to this extended level. Mm-hmm. Here.
Well, I think part of it is that sometimes there's a certain dwelling kind of low level suffering that masks. Is that what you're saying earlier? That you may be getting into low level misery that masks actually facing
people. People know that they're suffering, but they lie to themselves. They have a whole range. The cloud of knowing is full of little voices, little emotional habits that attempt to ameliorate and mitigate, explain away the suffering, and that pull the attention away from being simply present to the actual suffering. The actual suffering.
I should mention just operationally that there are practices that we've evolved that engage people in work units, like we call it co-meditation, where it's a two-person meditation. That can be done with a teacher, but it's also done with other students. And the intent of that is to get this stuff out. Because one of the most difficult things is that a lot of the things that we wallow most about are sort of our little internal secrets, and that if you speak them out in a context where someone is able to receive them without judging them, that actually shifts our relationship to them in some very interesting ways, and creates the conditions by which we might be able to move closer to the underlying roots of those things, as opposed to the kind of the surface distractions. So part of the answer to the question is that absolutely the ordinary identified mind wants to wallow in suffering. It's when we use a term like conscious suffering, however, that's a very different kind of event, because for a mind that's wallowing in sort of identified suffering, conscious suffering is sort of standing up above that, or putting that stuff, putting the light of day onto that kind of habit pattern, which is very uncomfortable, actually. Mm-hmm. And so in that kind of context, it's possible to move that energy and to release that energy such that we don't have the luxury of sort of having this private little suffering mill going on.
In a lot of ways, what happens is that people get locked, emotionally locked in a place. And it's sort of like, you know, if you have a lid on a jar that's stuck, what do you do? You try to create some movement. You might bang on it a little bit, actually, but you twist it both ways, perhaps, in order to get some movement to happen, so that it will unlock. And so movement of energy is, in the way that Stuart's talking about, is very helpful.
That kind of partial attention to suffering, but it isn't real presence. I think that's a way of like saying, well, I'm being present to my suffering, but not really.
Right, not really. Thank you. Well, I think we should.
I just want to add one thing. I want to pursue a thought with you, which is the conscious being. I was in a sauna today, so I was attempting to experience the intensity of heat, and I jacked up the heat. So the trick was, ordinarily, what I will do is when the heat gets too, it begins to be severe, I will start reading, start moving my legs, I do various forms of diversion, so I do not have to experience the depth of it. And my question is this: the willingness to stay there and experience the discomfort and the pain in its purest form, I know has value. Now, where can you take it from there? That's the question.
Why do you assume that the generation of pain in and of itself is a value? I don't accept that premise.
Oh, you asked the question. I'll give you the answer. I'll allow me to answer you.
Okay.
Don't answer your own question. Go ahead, let me answer. what's happening is it's the willingness simply to challenge my own mental faculties, which ordinarily want to divert and see what happens if I don't do the diversion. I'm going to stay there just to see where will this come? What will come forth as a result of this? And so the question was, if one was to stay with this, what could one expect or hope? You might hope. What could one expect would be the result of this?
Got that. My own view is that these sorts of efforts, without an overarching process that is meticulous and consistent, will only yield results that apply to a small part of the cloud of knowing. And to have an encompassing effect, we need to have an encompassing context. And the creation, and what we've been talking about tonight, is the creation of a context through establishing conditions which are often uncomfortable. I mean, I certainly agree with you to that extent. But it's not just the creation of uncomfortable conditions, because that can so easily get into exactly what Madeline is talking about, with a sort of determination, or telling oneself a story that just suffering is good. I do not subscribe to that position. Just suffering is just suffering. What I want to do is use suffering to expand the parameters of consciousness such that we create these conditions whereby something extraordinary can happen to the entirety of this cloud of knowing, which is actually a cloud of knowing ignorance. Ignorant knowing. Small-minded knowing. And that's the difficulty. So we may have a terminological difficulty, but I think it's crucial to remember that suffering in and of itself is not the point. When we write conscious suffering on the title for this talk, we are not saying all suffering is good, and let's just intensify it and have at it. No, it has to be part of a comprehensive, meticulous, well-directed process. And without that, it's just, you know, basically going to go in the direction that that Madeline, this lady over here, is talking about. Does that make sense?
I'd like to try this out.
I'll tell you what. Let's talk about this ourselves. You can talk about this with us later, but I think a lot of people here are ready to head out.
You're very much aware of that. Yes.
I got that. Yes. Well, no, it's actually 9:18, which is later than almost.
You weren't aware of it at 9:17 when you were talking.
I got that. I was responding to your question, and I do get to have the last word in my talk.
Sure you do. That's been my experience. Yeah.
Good. Okay. Well, then thank you for giving me the last word.
It wasn't my choice.
All right. I got that. Well, and I take it back.
Thank you.
Thank
All right.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for attending. One quick announcement. There is a donation ball on the counter. A portion of our donation goes to our speakers to support their work, and a portion goes to our store so we can have events here. Continue to have events here. And don't forget Many Rivers when you do your holiday shopping.
Indeed.
Get Many Rivers at the top of your list. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.